Okay. So, we grade the exams. There's midterm and final. The midterm is going to be, like I said, it's multiple choice with some true and false, A, B, C, D. So there'll be fact patterns, there'll be paragraphs or what have you guys have to read. There are roughly 40 questions on the midterm and 35 on the final. So they're pretty close. The final is always a little bit shorter. On the final, I will have, I can't remember on the midterm, but on the final for sure, I also have extra credit questions. So if you don't get them right, it doesn't affect your grade. If you get it right, it bumps your grades up. And so with any multiple guess type question, if you get to the end of the exam and you're running out of time and you haven't been able to read the last two or three extra credit questions, just circle something because you may get it right and you'll get credit for it. Like, don't leave those blank because they're never going to hurt you on that side. Okay? The exams are open book, open notes. The only thing I don't want you guys to do is be typing to each other by instant messages and everything else once you get for answer 12. But you can bring in all these notes. Whatever you guys want to do, you can bring it in. Anything's open for you. I will be telling you throughout the semester, pay attention to this slide. It's going to be on the exam. Mark that for yourself. So when you get to that, you're like, oh my God, he talked about this. So you can go back and find it. I'm just giving you some tips. Like I said, I want to help you guys in this class. I don't want to hurt you. So that will be happening. I'll be like, you will hear me throughout the semester say, this will be on the exam, and it'll come from that slide. Okay? So I talked about the B101 and the A201. The opportunity to raise your grade of C or below by writing papers. So if you get a C or you get below that, and I have more flexibility, but I always put it as far as the lecture on this. If you get a C or below and you're like, oh, I thought he said he was going to help us out here. I do. So what you do is you send an email and you say, hey, I want to bump my grade up. And I'll say, okay, pick a topic. Go back through the six or seven lectures that we had before the exam, and you're going to say, I want to write a paper on torts. They're like, okay, that's great. Can we refine it? What kind of tort? What do you want to write on? So I will help you narrow it down, because if you want to write a tort, it'll take you forever to write a three-page double-spaced paper. It's not very difficult to do. You should be able to knock it out in about 2 hours. I'll narrow it down for you, and you can say, I want to talk about this project that I read about where a guy fell off a crane and there was a lawsuit. And then you write about that, and as long as it's cogent and it doesn't have typos, your grade goes from a C to a B. Three-page double-spaced. Not that difficult. People have done it throughout all the years here because I want to help you guys out. If you got a B and you want an A, it's still 3 or 4 page double space. I wanted to see just a little bit better, just to get from the B to the A. But I will do that as well. Okay? Send me an email. Hey, I want to bump my grade up to an A. Fine. What's your topic? We pick a topic. You write it up. I take a look at it. I'm like, oh, this looks pretty good. I'll bump you up to an A. Okay? Because again, I don't want to hurt you guys. And to your point, there have been people that said this exam is really hard. They walk in and like, oh my God, I didn't understand it. And I'm not trying to make it easier. I'm trying to make it so you can understand it better. And I've changed many questions over the years. And what we do is we have a sit down, and I have to figure out how this is going to work this year. Normally what happens, and I apologize for this in advance unless the case settles. Normally what happens is the week after the midterm, I bring you guys all down to my office, and I feed you guys, and I give you a tour, and you can see what a big fancy law firm. My law firm has 1,300 people in it. Our main office is based in Seattle. They've got about 500 in that office. But we have 150 people in the office. And the brand new offices that we moved in about a year and a half ago, they're spectacular. The design was, I'm trying to remember whoever the design worked for. I can't remember. But the offices are beautiful. So I have you guys come in, and we actually go through the exam, and we talk about it. And you'll be like, this question was unfair. I'll be like, you're right, it is. And then I'll throw that out as a question, and I'll adjust grades accordingly and everything else. This year, we may not be able to do that because I'm in trial. And so what normally happens is if I'm in the middle of the trial, I can't have you guys come down because I'll be working probably till midnight that night anyway. So we're going to play it by ear. As we move along, there's a chance cases always settle and everything else. That's not till late February, early March, which is when this thing may be wrapping up. But the point is if we get the grades back, again, not only will I give you the opportunity to bump your grade, but if you feel that there's something about the question, something about the way it is, you can come up to me at class before or after. You can come up to me and you can send me an email or whatever. And I am happy to look back and say, you know what, you're right. this question didn't make sense because I wrote it like a lawyer and you guys aren't lawyers. And I will change your grade, or if it changes your grade, but I will change necessarily the answer on that question. Okay? So I emphasize all this because I just want it to be, I want you guys to learn and be fair. I don't want this to be about my grades. So I wanted to tell you that. Attendance, though, is critical for understanding. I do not take attendance. I do not mandate attendance. But I can tell you, for teaching this for 14 years, those who don't show get bad grades. That's just the way it is, because as much as you may tune me out while we're here in the class, if you're listening to me on an MP4, while you're cleaning the house, while you're driving to work, whatever it might be, you're not going to even listen to me at all. And you're not going to be scrolling through the slides. Some people do, but by and large, the people, and there are going to be, and I cast no aspersions on you guys, some of you guys will just attend this class less. It's just the reality of doing it for years. I don't care. I'm not going to knock you down because your grades are going to be purely on what you answered on the test. I don't have any attendance requirement. I don't have any class participation requirement. But I will tell you, pretty much if you don't attend, your grades will be lower. It's just, that's just what happens in my class. I've been doing this long enough, so I just want to let you know. So I'd rather you be here. If you can't because of something, I understand, that's why the lectures are. You want to make sure your grades are better, you don't have to write a paper? Come and spend Friday with me. Other than that, it's up to you guys. You guys are all grown up, you know what you're doing. Here's the other thing. The lectures, I said, posted on the website. The last one's why you want to show up to class. The person who has the best raw score in this class, not adjusted, where you write it up or you give me a paper or whatever, the best combined raw score for both tests at the end of the semester, $1,000 comes from me to you, not from the school. I donate to the school, but it's for you guys. It's a meritorious award, and the best, and we give it out every year. I have given out, one year there was a tie, I gave out $1,000 to each student. I am praying that there's never going to be where there's three people get the same grade. So, because I just don't want to do that, but that's the reality. So, we'll cross the bridge when we come to it. It's only happened once where there's two people. But there's a reason. So there's an incentive here. I want you guys to enjoy the class. And what I have found, almost without a doubt, the person who has won it in almost every year is the person that talks the most in the class and shows up. The one that is engaged and interactive. Because, as I said, psychology and studies have shown, if you ask questions and if you interact, you will understand more. And that's why you should be here and raise your hand. $1,000. It's up to you guys. Whatever. I will tell you why I have this, too. When I went to architecture school, 100 years ago, I graduated in 87, we did our thesis project, and I did a design thesis. My thesis project was, I did an Olympic training center, a velodrome and an auditorium out in Colorado Springs, and it was very cool. You guys, if we have the session where you guys come down to my office, if it works with my trial schedule or anything else, I still have my portfolio that I put together right after I graduated from school, and it's at my office. And so I let you guys see what I did, my paintings and my drawings and what we did in the old days, because it wasn't on CAD, so it's actually real drawings and things. And so I have my thesis in there. And what I did for the roof structure of this velodrome is a cycling track, if you guys know, it's an indoor cycling track. And because I was big into cycling and triathlons and everything else at the time. And so for the roof structure of this velodrome, I actually, if you think about a bicycle wheel is the spokes are in tension and the wheels in compression. And so it's a very, really sound structural piece. And if you turn it on its side, it doesn't matter whether it's riding this way as a bike with the wheels, but you turn it on its side, it still has the same structural properties. And because of the way the thing's in tension, you can actually hang things from those tension spokes, so to speak. And you can hang a roof system from that. And there had been some roof systems. You can go out and look in the time I was kind of investigating this. And there had been some roof systems that were based on a bicycle wheel. What I did, though, is I actually took two bicycle wheels and I combined them together. And then I had this massive truss system. And I went to, at the time, even though I didn't need to, I went and sat down with one of the senior engineers at Notre Dame Structural Engineering School of Engineering. And we actually did the modeling of it, that this roof system would work. So sitting on top, and the way the roof system was, it floated between the spokes. So when you were in the stands, if it ever had been built, you would look up and you would see these two bicycle wheels that were over this velodrome track. And I was very proud of it. As a result of that, I ended up winning an award, and I got, it was like probably $50. It wasn't very much money back in 1980, maybe $200. I don't know. But I was like, that was the coolest thing that I ever felt coming out of architecture school. Like, I love my presentations, and I love the award, doing what we did and everything else. But I always thought it was cool. It's like, I got a little bit back. So that's why I do this for you guys, because it felt good to me that I won this award. And so I want somebody here to feel like, now I have to call it a merit award as opposed to what, I don't know, but there's some rules about what it's supposed to be called. But you guys get the merit award for your scores for the grade. So, any questions on this so far? All right. Okay. Let's report. I'm scrolling down here. Objectives of the class. So we talked a little bit about this before we in the beginning. I want you guys to kind of learn the jargon of a lawyer, the jargon of the business people. Again, it'll be more heavily lawyer because I'm a lawyer. But I want you to hear this so you can understand. So when I do say tort, hopefully at the end of this semester, when somebody says, oh, there was a tort, or you're reading a newspaper article or whatever, you will know what that means. So you're going to learn the jargon. There's going to be lots of stuff that you're going to hear about, like mechanics liens and all the stuff that will become. And most of the stuff that I'm going to talk about will be very relevant when you get out and practice. And you will be able to hear that. And you'll be talking to your colleagues or other people, and you're going to understand. And again, that will help elevate you because you understand what the jargon is. I want you to start, one of the things we're going to talk about types of practices, the business side of it. Are you a sole proprietor? Are you a partnership? Are you a corporation? Are you an LLC? And what's the difference and why would you do that? Why would you be a corporation versus an LLC? So I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. We're not going to get into the law of it. We're going to just explain some high-level stuff. So like, oh, that makes sense. Why don't we do that? I want you to understand dispute resolution. Unfortunately, well, fortunately for me because I'm a lawyer, there will be disputes on your projects. Things will go wrong. Maybe it's as tragic as somebody falls off of a building and they crack their head open. Maybe it's as simple as a wall fell down, or maybe it's that the door doesn't close properly and we have to fix it because it wasn't designed right or wasn't built right. But disputes happen. And I need you to understand that. How do we resolve those disputes? Is it through the trial? Is it through a mediation? Is it through an arbitration? What does that all mean? So I want to talk about that. We'll get you guys to have a better feel of that. I want you to understand business agreements and contracts. There are concepts that you guys will have throughout the rest of the course of your career. And even if, you know, I will tell you this. So I graduated my class when we ended up, I think we started with like 50-some the first year. And this is a certain, it's not ironic, it just was timely. The very first lecture, a gentleman named Professor Steve Hurst, he ended up becoming dean of Virginia's School of Architecture, but he was one of just a regular professor when we had him. And he got up to class, and the very first thing he said of the very first lecture is he said, look left and look right. At least one of those two people will not be here when you graduate. And we started with like 50 or 60, or like 55 or 60 people that first semester. We graduated 33. He was right. He also, this is why I said it was kind of timely, he talked about two icons in the class, because architecture is about icons. Architecture is about what you think about. Think about some of the most important buildings you're ever going to see, or maybe not the most important buildings, but there's famous buildings. Like, if I said the Eye of London, you guys would all know what I'm talking about, some big giant Ferris wheel, right? You know, if I said the Sears Tower, you all know what it is, because they are iconic. Some of the things you guys are designing are iconic. I know one of the things about this class is less about, every year, depending on what your professors are, what you guys are working on in the third year can be different, but you guys are much more urban. Is this school is an urban type concept as opposed to just building buildings and designing buildings. But I mean, if you think about it, if you look at like if I talk about the mall of the capital of Washington, D.C., iconically, we all know what that feels like. So he talked about two icons. He talked about the Marlboro Man, which used to be this very famous poster you would see with this guy with the cowboy hat, and he just was this iconic American person that they used to sell cigarettes. And this is when cigarettes were a lot different, but he was this icon. The other icon he talked about was Michael Brady, so I felt right at home when I first got the Notre Dame. But I want you to understand some of the, so those are important things about icons and understanding agreements, understanding communications and things. So when we get into contracts and business relationships, I want you to understand about what this stuff means and why it's important to you in your practice. We need to talk about the practice of architecture, how it's regulated by the states. You guys will be under a laws that tell you, hey, I got to follow this. I can't just go out and do what I want to do. I can't raise my hand and be an architect if I'm not licensed. I can say I practice architecture or I design, But there are different things, and the state allows you to do that. And if you don't follow the rules, there are ramifications. We'll talk a little bit about that. Once you learn and understand an architect's professional practice responsibilities, do you have obligations to society when you're designing? You're hired by Bob Smith to design this building. But what must you think about with respect to everybody else in the world if Bob Smith tells you to do something? So what are those obligations and your professional practice responsibilities, not just to your client, but to everybody else? We're going to understand the economics of architecture and real estate. I talked a little bit about that briefly. We'll talk about if you're going to develop a project, and we will go through a sample, I think it's a 100-unit building, and how much is it going to cost to develop? How much is it going to cost for rent? How much is it going to cost to sell? Can you make a profit? Can you make a profit? So not make a profit. So the lecture is appropriately called The Economics of Construction. So we're going to talk about that. And then recognizing the architect's place in the business world. Where the architect's place in the business world? Where do I stand in the pecking order? You got the owner, and we'll start even from right now. I want you guys to always think about this throughout the rest of your career. From the top is the owner. The reason why they're on the top is because they have the money and they hire you guys. Your world is a triangle. Okay? On one corner of the triangle is the architect, and the other corner of the triangle is the contractor. The owner's on top. Owner's going to have a solid line between owner and contractor, and owner's going to have a solid line between owner and architect. So you have a triangle with solid lines in that drawing and what it looks like. That solid line means there's a contract and there's obligations contractually back and forth. The base of this triangle is a dotted line. There is no connection legally, contractually, between the architect and the contractor in the traditional triangle. But you have obligations to each other that flow through your triangle arms that are solid. I will talk about the triangle dozens of times throughout the semester, but I just wanted to lay that down. Where is your place in the business world? Well, the owner is the one that's king with dollars, but how does that relate to you in the project? Where does it relate to you, how much money you're going to make, how much risk you take, how much risk does a contractor take? Some of you guys may get out there and you might go work for a construction firm. You may not work for an architecture firm. So I'm not only going to be focusing on what an architect looks like, although it'll be more heavy architecture than contractor, but that's important for you guys to understand where you are in the business world. Okay? Okay, any questions? So that's the class as an overview. Any questions on that or what we're going to be talking about this semester? Good. So, let's talk basic law as an overview. Let's just start with the most high-level theory that we have here. So we have, at the very top, the highest up, the laws of nature. And why do we talk about the laws of nature? Well, because it's actually relevant for you guys when you design a building. One of the laws of nature is gravity. One of the laws of nature is wind. One of the laws of nature is going to rain. There's going to have precipitation. Those things are going to happen, and you must take those all into account when you design. If you don't take the gravity into account, if you're not dealing with loads, snow loads, and other, not taking wind loads into account, your building may sink, your building may fall down. So those are things that are actually relevant. So we start at the very top. The laws of nature are important to architecture. Okay? The next set of laws, other than following nature, when we got into a society started to develop, because even way back before there was architects, they had to follow the law of nature when they were making teepees and tents and lean-tos. I mean, they weren't called architects, they were just people building shelters, but they had to use those and incorporate it. And then as society went along and people started becoming, they would form cities and everything else, they started creating laws. And we had a monarchy. Monarchy was the king said everything, and the king made all the decisions, you had to follow that. That, of course, as I say, as simply as possible, led to tyranny. People finally started saying, I'm tired of one person telling me what to do. We need to have something more. And so then if we get into the Greek world, we go to Greece, we have the concepts of democracy came into play. Plato, Socrates, and democracy came something where the people started thinking about, God, what's important here to us? And the Greek system was a pure democracy. So we live in a republic. We don't live in a pure democracy in the States. We all know that. But in Greek, every person had one person, one voice. And so that's how they ran their society, okay? So it's something that you guys, is it relevant to architecture? No, but its laws started becoming more developed. And the reason that I say unworkable here is because ultimately one person, one voice was not enough because you had so many fractions and splits and everything else. So you had to come to, the next would be another type of theory of how laws are put together and how societies work, what's important for people as a whole, how their mindsets are. We have socialism, communism. There are various other types of legal systems of how companies or countries run, or groups of people run, how organizations are. So those are some of the things that as people living together started moving along, they started developing these concepts. When we get to where we are, at least in the United States, we are a constitutional democracy. So we talk about democracy, people vote, we all vote and everything else, and you have a voice, but because of that, you voice, you vote, and you bring in your representatives, and the Constitution is structured that way. And all these laws are relevant from how the Constitution, it's our form of government. It's where the majority, though, doesn't always rule, because the majority of people may not be the way they represented, and certainly the way our constitutional democracy is put together between the Senate and the House of Representatives, if you think about it, in the Senate, and I know probably we all know this, but I cover this in my lecture anyway, it doesn't matter, certainly on the Senate side, it doesn't matter if you're in California or you're in Nebraska, there's only two senators. So Nebraska has an equal voice of California does, even though California has tens and tens more number of people that live there. So it's not based on population, it's not based on majority. How we balance that with the House of Representatives. Nebraska only has a few people in the House of Representatives, California has many more, and so we have this situation where we try to balance as far as the voice of the country. So that's this constitutional democracy for us. Ultimately, the concept of talking about these laws, why I'm talking about, and by the way, I'm not going to, so sometimes I will say it this way, I am not going to quiz you on feudalism or tyranny or laws of nature or anything else. I just want to set this up as why we're going through this, okay? Ultimately, the purpose of laws, and the most probably the most important thing for you guys just to think about, the purpose of laws is to protect people. When you're building a building, or when you were building a lean-to or a teepee thousands of years ago, the laws of nature were important to you because you didn't want someone to be exposed to the elements or it would fall on you, because you wanted to protect them, so you created shelter. When we got into monarchy or democracy or some of these other types of forms of government, they still were designed to protect the people. It's a different philosophy of how they want to protect, but the king hopefully was a benevolent king, and they still decided to do things to protect the people. So laws are there to protect people. And so when you're practicing architecture and you have to follow the laws of what a code is or what a statute is or what a regulation is of where you're building it, if you're building in California, you're going to have to follow laws and codes that deal with earthquakes. If you're building in Illinois, you're going to have to follow laws and codes that deal with snow loads. That's for protection. So we put these in place. So that's why I'm kind of going through and talking about what laws, what they are for, and why they are relevant to the practice of architecture. Ultimately, you guys will have to follow the law in the course of you being an architect. Any questions on that? Okay? All right. So let's talk about, well, now we're just here in the U.S. and about now. We're not talking about anything else. So we have now levels of government, okay? The top is at the national level. It's not federal. There is a federal government, and you will hear a federal statute, but it's laws that apply to the whole nation. It's a national type situation, okay? And you can only you may only exercise that power expressly granted to you in the Constitution. So the federal laws come and they start from the basis of the Constitution. However, the Constitution gives power to Congress to create laws. And so that's why you can find a law that was made by Congress and it doesn't come word for word from the Constitution. But if someone challenges that law and it comes all the way up to the Supreme Court, they are going to look at that law that the Congress created, and they're going to say, is it acceptable under our Constitution? So the Constitution sits at the top. It is the highest part up there as far as the laws that regulate everything that we do. Okay? Now, certain powers in the Constitution are reserved for the states. So one of the things, I mean, it's up, and we're all talking about it right now. I mean, not we're all talking about it, but it's at least in the news and other things, is it up to Congress to tell you how voting works, or is it up to the state? And the Constitution gives it to the states. The states are the ones that handle how voting happens. So that's going to be, that's an issue that's actually up right now. But it's something that you can understand as far as certain portions and certain powers the Constitution specifically grants to the states. And the third, and the Constitution can be very broad in its application, and Congress can do what it wants to do. So when laws are being created, like there's what's called the Commerce Clause, and that allows the Congress to regulate business between state to state under commerce. That's just huge. Commerce. Commerce is any business of anything. And so they take this giant umbrella of commerce and they can say, well, I can regulate taxes here, I can regulate this, I can regulate that. So there's lots and lots of authority that's granted through this Constitution. So that's at the national level. We go down next to the state level. Okay, each state is wholly and separate and not obligated to follow each other's state laws. So we have a law in Illinois that says X, and you go to Wisconsin, you go to Michigan, you go to Ohio, you may not have that same law. And you don't have to follow it, but when you're in Illinois, you need to follow Illinois laws. When you're in Wisconsin, you follow Wisconsin laws. So each state, through the Constitution, is allowed to create their own set of laws. And that's relevant for architecture because there are, and we'll get to this, again, I'm not sure if it's, I don't think it's this lecture, we're going to get into some states are called practice states for architecture. If you're practicing architecture, it's called a practice state. Other states are called holding out states. When you're holding yourself out to be an architect as opposed to practice. And we'll explain the difference. So even with respect to state-to-state in the practice of architecture or being an architect, you have different requirements, different licensing obligations, how long you must practice before you can take your exam, all different sorts of things. So there is, however, what's called a full faith and credit clause in the Constitution, so that's the national level, and it says for states we give what's called full faith and credit. That it requires one state to recognize the validity of another state's decision. So, and this is not an issue, I raise it this way because it's just the simplest example to understand. Marriage is now allowed in every state, it doesn't matter whether what your sex is. But previously, you couldn't have same-sex marriages in many states. Massachusetts was one of the first ones that allowed same-sex marriages. If you got married in Massachusetts and you were considered married in Massachusetts and you moved to Illinois, Illinois needs to recognize that that is a married couple. Even though, and I don't know if Illinois at the time when this happened, if they had same-sex or not. But if you go to a state that didn't have on their laws the same-sex marriage ability, you have to have full faith and credit for whether they got married. They're a married couple there, they're still a married couple here. And that was some of the constitutional challenges that came up about insurance and everything else, and that's why ultimately the law was changed, one of the reasons why the law was changed, but it's now been recognized in the Supreme Court, and you can have same-sex marriage in every state in the union. So now that's at a national level, but before states had different ideas. That happens with different things with businesses and corporations and practice of architecture. If you're licensed as an architect in one state, it's recognized that when you move to the other state, that they are a license. So if you're licensed in Pennsylvania and you move to Illinois, it's recognized that you still have a Pennsylvania license. It's not recognized, but you're not licensed in Illinois. So Illinois doesn't say you're licensed in Illinois, but Illinois must recognize that you're a licensed Pennsylvania architect. Okay? So that's just full faith and credit. And again, you'll see this thing again. The laws are intended to protect both the rich and poor. It's not, it's just everybody. So we have these laws put together at a state level. We first had it at a national level, now a state level, to make sure we're protecting everybody. When we get to the municipal level, which is the cities you're living in, they're going to have their own laws and codes. So you're going to have state codes for building. You're going to be, the state of Illinois adopts, it used to be called BOCA, now it's called, I think it's UIC or UCI. Anyway, it's an international code, but there's a code that for everybody has to adopt. But then when you come and you build in Chicago, if you build something in Chicago, they have their own Chicago codes, and you have to follow those. So you're going to have either city villages or separate independent taxing bodies. They are going to have laws that apply to you. I'll give an example of this last one of the separate independent taxing body, the Metropolitan Pier and Exposition Authority, which is McCormick Place. You guys all know McCormick Place? So that was my client. McCormick Place and Navy Pier was my client for about 20 years. And they did a number of their expansions. If you guys, I don't know if you guys have been down, there's a new hotel, and then it's not new anymore, but they have a 1,200-room hotel, and then they have their arena, where they have DePaul, DePaul plays the basketball games there, and then they bring in concerts and stuff like that. I did all the contracts for that. And when you were working as an architect or a contractor for the MPEA, you had to follow laws of the state of Illinois. You had to follow laws of the city of Chicago. And then the MPEA had some of its own specific laws about design and construction they had to follow as well. So all three are state and city, and then even down to the separate municipal organization. MPEA is its own separate testing body. It could create its own laws. You had to follow those as well. So as you go out as an architect, one of the things that you will look for is you're going to have to say, what codes apply to me? You know, like your client comes in and hires you and says, hey, I got this piece of property. I want you to build me a house there. First thing you're going to look at is you're going to say, is that zoned for residential? Because I got to look at the local zoning codes. And if it's zoned for residential, great. If it's zoned for industrial, then you got to go back to the city, the village, the state, whatever it is, and you have to change that. And you have to get the zoning changed before you can even design that. So those are laws that probably none of you guys ever even think about because you're not out there practicing, but you have to make sure those are followed. And then once you figure out, okay, now it's designed and it's zoned for residential, is there a setback? Is there a height requirement? Are there other things that come in that are relevant to that city or that state or the neighborhood that are at the municipal level that laws are applicable for? So those are now that we're getting to like specifics of what may happen with you guys in the practice of architecture. Questions on that? Okay. A couple other laws that we're going to have. Criminal law, you're not going to be questions on anything because it really has nothing. Well, I won't say nothing to do with practice architecture because there are sometimes when architects commit fraud and they lie and they steal and then there's crimes that are committed, but we're not going to have anything in the exam on criminal laws. But criminal laws are relevant here in the sense of just talking about laws as a theory at the high level. Once again, the laws are there to protect the state and to protect the people. That's what we have. That's why we have these criminal laws, so people can go out and do whatever they want. If not, it would be crazy and people could take advantage and otherwise. I know it's so simple and basic, but that's what I want you guys to hear, is what laws are there. They're here to protect people. We do have a jury system in our country. So while I said I'm going to be in an arbitration, a 10 or 12 week arbitration starting next week, there are no jurors in there. There's just three members on a panel that are going to be making the decisions as to who's right or wrong or who gets money, who doesn't get money. But the jury system is always in criminal. So you always will have, because the Constitution, remember way up top, the national level? The Constitution said you must and are entitled to be tried by a jury of your peers. Where did that come from? Remember when I was talking about the monarchy and that it led to tyranny? Because before, hundreds of years ago, what would happen is the king or queen would lay down their scepter and say yes or no, or if we went back to Rome, thumbs up or thumbs down. That didn't sit well with the people of the world. And so things changed and we ultimately got here, and there was not, and there still are not, all countries certainly do not have a jury system. We are one of the unique ones that you're guaranteed a jury here. We are also unique that you're considered innocent before proven guilty in the United States. Not unique, but not every country has innocent before proven guilty in the United States. If you read about, there was a guy that just was recently released from prison. They called him, I think his last name was Pistorius. It was down in South Africa. And he was found guilty of killing, I don't know if it was his girlfriend or his wife. He had the blades. He was the blade runner. He had these artificial legs and everything else. The whole South African legal system is entirely different as far as how you're considered guilty or innocent first, and it's completely different than ours. So, but it's important just to recognize what the jury of your peers are, to understand that. Again, we won't be tested on it. I just want to kind of, I just touch on it because it's relevant for protections of people and laws. Civil law, a little bit more important to us because you will be practicing under the civil laws, the law of society that tells you need to do this. And sometimes the civil law can be as simple as, I need to make sure that I act responsibly and I'm not negligent. And if I am negligent and someone gets hurt, I may be liable for that. So there's some words, like liability, negligence. Negligence is you screwed up. You didn't do what everybody should do. Liable means you have to pay for that person's damages. If someone gets injured because of your mistake, your negligence, you are liable. That's all in the fabric of civil law. So I'm going to trial or arbitration hearing next week because the allegations that my client, I represent the owner in this situation, so we have brought the claim. My allegations are against the contractor. The contractor failed to properly build this building. There are many, many things that are wrong with this building, and so we are going under a civil remedy, using arbitration, to try to recover the cost that my client must pay to fix her building. So, what do we do here? One of the things that happens in civil law is we balance the interests between groups and individuals. Who's important or not? Is it more important for the big group, or is it more important for the individual? And it may depend. You know, the needs of the few, the needs of the one. It all depends. And probably the two most, my most favorite words as a lawyer, but most lawyers' two most favorite words is when you ask them a question, you say it depends, because it depends on the facts. And I will say that many, many times. Some people, you guys will ask me a question and be like, well, it depends. It's not a hedge, it's not a waffle, it's just facts are important, and facts are relevant in how we determine the balance of interest between groups and individuals. The other thing that civil law is, and all laws are that, are to ensure predictability. If the law says you must do X, everybody will expect you to do X. So it's predictable, and we have consistency. And to protect people, knowledge is important. Knowledge is important to understand. So if an architect is expected to do X and they do Y, that may be a problem. It may not be, because it depends on what Y is. Y may be something like X but more. Y may be completely deviant from that. We don't know until we see what the facts are. But it's important for the laws, and it's important for your practice, whether it's the laws of nature, so you guys make sure that the building doesn't fall down from wind load or gravity, or whether it's the laws that you follow the code, you want predictability in your building so people are safe. There's statutes in common law. We'll talk about that in a second, but we have statutes of actual laws written on the books. You can find somewhere they have actually written it down. That's a statute. Common law is, this is what happens in the industry. This is what happens in society, and you bring this to the court, and the court says, oh, I'm looking at the groups and the individual, and this happens over and over and over again, so I'm going to rule on this case based on what happens in society, what happens in the industry, what it might be. And that becomes a law from what the case law says, and over time it becomes common law. It becomes regular. It may not ever make it into a statute, but I get an issue, and I read the issue, and I see in the law, I get an issue in a case, and I'm like, oh, do I have to do A or B? And I read a bunch of case laws that have facts similar to my situation, and there's going to be more cases that are going to say you have to do A than B. That becomes common law. It becomes more common that the courts say you must follow this path, or that the result of your actions follow this path. So that's common law, different than a statute. And then with civil law, you do also have a jury system, but it's not guaranteed. Criminal, an individual who's been charged with a crime, is guaranteed a jury of his peer by the U.S. Constitution. In civil law, you must request a jury. So we're going to arbitration. My case is worth over $10 million. It's not to a jury. Because when the contracts were signed years ago, neither party said we must have a jury. You can agree to a jury in the beginning. You can agree to a jury in the middle. And if you do, then you get a jury. And so I've only had one case that went to jury. A lot of law, and you guys may have heard this, most litigation, most disputes in the law don't go to trial. It's really expensive and it's really stressful, and I haven't slept for like 2 weeks. But it's very expensive and it's very risky. In this instance, because we never agreed to a jury, the parties made a decision way back when, we're just going to go to this arbitration panel. And it's okay. We're going to have three people that are knowledgeable in the field make the decision. So it's not a guaranteed jury, but you can have them in civil cases. Any questions on that? Yes?
Yeah, so would the jury start for that kind of case? You say the jury first, like criminal case?
Great question. So the question is, and a lot of times I'm going to repeat the question because so you guys will hear this later if you aren't, so you can be like, what did they say? Like, you'll be listening and stuff. So I'll do it. The question was, is the jury the same? And I'm assuming you're saying the same for like a jury for a criminal trial versus a jury for a civil trial. The answer is yes, kind of. So depending on where you are, like if you're in a small little town or even a medium-sized town, there may be only one courthouse. And so every certain times they have trials, they have trials on certain days, and they bring in a jury pool, and you'll get a jury summons, and you show up, and you may be showing up for, and you'll all be sitting in a room, and then they say, okay, you go to courtroom one, you go to courtroom two, you go to courtroom three, and it could be one criminal, one civil, and one's maybe two civil. And then when you're in there, the juries will be selected, either through the judge or the lawyers will be a jury. It's called voir dire, it's a French word. And what you'll do is you'll ask questions of each individual jury. What do you do for a living? You know, you get some facts. You can say, I like this juror. The process of voir dire is relatively similar from courtroom to courtroom, whether it's criminal or civil. But they will have that. And it's just people. It's not like, oh, I'm only going to be a criminal lawyer. I'm only going to be a criminal juror. I'm only going to be a civil juror. So if you're a smaller area and there's like a central courthouse, it may not be, you just go to where they assign the courtroom. In Chicago, if you're going to, you may be summoned to go to 26th in California, which is all criminal. So if you guys ever get a jury summons, and it's 26th in California, you know you will be on a criminal trial because they only do criminal cases there. If you get a summons to show up to the Daly Center downtown in Chicago, you will be in a civil trial. And that's because we have a civil courthouse and a criminal courthouse. That's the only reason why they're different. But the people that are called, you randomly just come up and you get a civil summons and you have to show up. So, I've been called to jury trial three or four times. Sometimes you'll see when you get the summons, it'll say call the night before. You may not even have to come in. So I called the night before and they said I didn't have to come in for most recent one. But I have been called before. Sometimes you sit in this room with, like, I've been, most of my time, almost all the time, actually, let me think about it. Every time I've had to show up for jury duty, it's always been at 26 in California. I've never had to go to the Daly Center. And you sit in this giant room with hundreds and hundreds of people, and two of the times I was there, and it's all day, and you're just waiting around, and eventually, like, 3 o'clock, they're like, you're all released, and then you've done your duty, but you're never even put on a jury. One time, I actually was called, or twice I've been called in to the courtroom. And then when you get to the courtroom, they send like 50 of you, 40 or 50 of you, and we sit in the bleachers, the galley, they call it, and then they put you in the box, in the jury box. So they go and they stick 12 people in the box, and the rest of us are sitting in the back, and they do the voir dire and they ask the questions. And as they go through, they're like, accept, reject, and so you can go home, reject, you can go home. So then now they have like 4 people, and they need they need either 12 or 18, because it could be a 6-person jury with 6 alternates, or it could be a 12-person jury with 6 alternates. So they put the ones they've selected, and then you go in again. Twice I've sat in the galley. One of those 2 times I made it all the way into the box, and then I was one of the first or second people they asked questions of, and they said, what do you do for a living? And I'm like, I'm a lawyer. And they're like, your excuse, because they don't want lawyers in the jury box. So, because I will, of course, be the foreman. I will know the law. I will lead the thing. And they're like, we don't even want this guy in here, so they're gone. In years past, it went away. Years past, there used to be excuses, like a natural excuse, because it became so common that lawyers would be tossed. They just said, okay, lawyers don't ever have to be one. And then they were like, okay, accountants don't have to be one. They started having all these professions that everybody was getting out, and we didn't have enough jurors showing up. So there are now no more automatic excuses. I got to show up. And then they may say, go home early, or they may say, no, I don't like you because you're a lawyer. But that's the process. Like I said, I haven't been a juror, a potential juror at the Daly Center, but it's possible that it's very likely it's the exact same scenario. So. Okay. Any more questions about the system? Yes, you had one. And then I'll get to you.
You said, like, if it doesn't have a jury, then it's called arbitration.
Great question.
Are there other, like, forms of not having a jury? Or, like,
yes.
Is arbitration the only one?
Yes, great question. Is arbitration the only dispute resolution process if there's not a jury? The answer is no. And I think we get that into our slides here today. So there are 2 routes for dispute. Well, 2 main routes. There's a whole bunch of hybrids that are out there that have come in the past years. But there are 2 main routes for dispute resolution in the civil sense. Litigation, which you go to court and there is a judge. Arbitration, it's a through various arbitration associations, and you have one or three panel members that are not necessarily judges. Often they are specialists in the field. So if you have, like we have a construction dispute that's starting up, and we have three construction lawyers that are going to be our arbitration panel. I've had other arbitrations where it's been one guy's an architect, one guy's a lawyer, and one woman was a contractor. So they are specialists in the field, but they are not judges, and they are trained how to arbitrate, but they're not like they have to be elected or appointed. On the litigation side, and there are never juries in arbitration. On the litigation side, you will always have a judge. There are specific rules of evidence. It's much more formal. It's what you see on TV. And that could be a bench trial. The concept of a bench trial is the judge that sits up on the bench will be making all the decisions without a jury. Or there could be a judge with a jury. And so the jury is going to make the ultimate decisions on the facts, and the judge will make the decisions on the law. So that's what happens on the litigation side. So arbitration and litigation are entirely separate. They're two different processes. And the parties must agree which route they're going to, and that often will be in the contract. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
You had a question.
Is jury duty
random? Yes. You will randomly come out, you have your Social Security or however it is, I don't know how the system works, and so you'll randomly get, my wife has been called for more jury duty than I have by like double, which is fine with me. And she actually served on a criminal trial for 6 days, and I don't think she was the foreman, but I know my wife, I'm sure she was one of the stronger leads in the jury room when they actually went up and made a decision. And I honestly don't remember whether they found the person guilty or not. I actually don't even remember what the case was about, but she did have a criminal trial where she sat on jury. So, yes, question. Yes, you file a lawsuit in court as litigation. I'm in a dispute resolution, which is arbitration. We do a lot of the same things. You take depositions, you exchange documents and everything else. Arbitration has a lot more flexibility. And the other thing that happens in arbitration that is very important, and why people decide to do arbitration is a private resolution. When you file a lawsuit with Cook County or any court, it becomes a public document. It's a public record. So some parties do not want their name in public. They don't want the dispute or what issues that could arise, because we all hope in the beginning of a construction project, we're all happy, we get along with the contract, we get along with the architect, and everything's going to be perfect. We hope it's going to be like that, and most of them are. But if something goes wrong, one party or the other, or maybe both parties, don't want their dirty laundry aired out there, so as a result they've elected arbitration as the resolution process as opposed to litigation. Question? Well, settling is it's a great question. So he asked is that like settling out of court? So settling out of court is a different concept. A settlement is when the parties are fighting and everything else, and the two parties decide we want to come to an agreement on that, and there's often an exchange of money, but not always. Maybe there's an exchange of obligations or whatever it is that's the settlement. That's something that the parties come to together. The arbitration panel or the judge and jury are the ones when they can't settle. They can't come to an agreement. And so they make the decision. In my case that I'm starting next week, we're the owner, and we have one lawsuit against the contractor and one lawsuit against the architect. Last week I settled with the architect. The panel will make no decisions on whether the architect did anything wrong. I don't care if they did anything wrong at this point in time. I'm still trying to see if I can settle with the contractor because I'd like to get my next 10 weeks back. But if we don't settle because it's not the right way, it doesn't have enough funds for my client, if she's been egregiously injured financially, then we won't settle. And then the panel will make the decision. But even during the course of the 10 weeks, we still could come to an agreement and say, that makes sense. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes you get into trial or into arbitration and you're 3 or 4 or 8 days in and it's going bad for you. It doesn't mean the party that went first it's going bad, but one party's like, ooh, this is not the way I thought it was going to come in. That may force people to settle. Settlement can happen at any time, but settlement is a business resolution between the parties as opposed to the judge or jury or arbitration panel making a legal decision of who's right and who's wrong. Okay? All right, any other questions on this? These are great. I really appreciate these. Why is this not scrolling? There we go. What's going on? Why are we not going further? Is that it? Okay. So that's great. I actually thought, yeah, there's a whole dispute resolution part that didn't make it in the slide. So what we're going to do then, because I don't have these slides up and I don't have a connection, I'm going to have to revamp, because what I wanted to talk about, but I'm going to let you guys go, because I don't want to have, because you don't have the slides before and I don't have the slides and I want to make sure we're talking about it. So what's going to happen is the dispute resolution stuff that we're going to talk about, because I was actually going to get into more about specifically between the difference between arbitration and litigation and those types of things and how those panel works and everything else. We will start that next week. Let me talk to you about how my classes work as far as timing, so I can stop this now. God, I didn't even realize that. That's really strange why this didn't come across. Let me check one last thing here real quick. Yeah. Okay.